Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to say a couple of quick things regarding the five branches of government that we talked about in previous audio snippets. We want to clarify a couple of things or expand on a couple of quick things, and then we'd like to go into a little bit of detail on what the judicial, the equivalent of the judicial branch would look like, within the realm of these five branches of government. As you may recall, the judicial branch would no longer exist. There would be no judicial branch. What we would call the judicial branch would be inside the legislative branch. Which would have three enforcement departments, as we described before, the police, the prosecutors, and the prison system. Those would be the three enforcement departments in charge of enforcing the laws passed by the legislative branch, by Congress. And that's why they need to be part of the legislative branch, because they are strict enforcers of the very laws that the legislature is passing. And the prosecutors, or which we optionally call the penalty assessors, would be the equivalent of what we now call the judicial branch. So in other words, the judges and the trial system and all that would be under the direct control and supervision of the legislative branch of Congress. They would be inside the legislative branch, and that would make a dramatic difference in many things, and it would by itself just take away this power of judicial activism that has crept into the American political system, and it's fitting because, as we've said a million times, a judge is supposed to be like a referee. A referee does not make up rules. A referee is not supposed to be constantly just deciding what when a judge or referee in a sport applies a rule, it's always an objective application of the rule. It's not like, oh, does he think it's a goal because he feels like it, or is it not a goal because he doesn't feel like it's a goal? No, it's either a goal or not a goal. And there's a very clear rule on what constitutes a goal and what doesn't. And all that the referee does is try to apply that law as strictly and correctly as possible. It's not a matter of interpretation. That's why it's important that the judicial system be inside the legislative branch, because all they are is very objective enforcers of the law. If the law is lacking, then the problem is not, okay, give more power to the judges, which is what we've done in the American system. No, the solution is clarify the law. So if the league passes a law that is very ambiguous and referees then there's controversy in one game that in one game the referee applied the rule in a certain way, in another game the referee applied the rule in a different way, then instead of saying, okay, that's fine, let's just make sure that we get good referees, no, people would say, no, there's something wrong with that law. We have to clarify it, because if it leaves so much room for interpretation, then the law is not specific enough. And that's what would be achieved by putting the judicial system inside the legislative branch. Then it says, okay, you're nothing, you're not the separate holy branch of government, you're just enforcers, that's all you are, of the law. If you have a problem enforcing it, then it's our job as legislators to clarify the law, and you're responsible to us for enforcing the law we pass. I mean, that's why people get elected to Congress, by the people. The people elect individuals to Congress so that they will pass legislation that fits a certain the will of the people. So if you are defying the legislative system, if you're defying the laws, then you're defying the will of the people. And we, and if since you are inside our house, then we have the authority to punish you and kick you out. Currently in the American system, you know, the judges are like, yes, they are approved by the Senate, but once they are approved, they go into the system and they get separated from Congress. And then they do their own thing and no one can stop them. But here it's like they are, you know, just like a referee is an employee of the league that passes the rules that are supposed to rule the sport in question. So if the league sees that a referee is constantly misapplying the rules that they have passed, then they get rid of the referee and put in a new one. And that's how it should be in the system. And if there's a problem with the legislative branch, then the people have a chance to re-elect new people and replace them. And on top of that, if the legislative branch is passing laws that are unfair, you have the president who can veto the laws, and you have the House of Centuries, as we call them. And sometimes I feel like maybe another name more fitting would be House of Sentinels. But regardless of how they're called, the House of Centuries, let's keep calling them that. The House of Centuries has the authority to call them out, the legislative branch, and it can even veto legislative bills under certain circumstances as we described before. So it's not like the legislators would become the dictators and no one would be able to stop them. But to give the judicial branch this very ample leeway and autonomy that we have given it only leads to problems, because then we have one judge overturning a law on his own. You know, he decides, and if you get a nut job liberal judge, then you're doomed. And if you get a conservative judge, then, you know, things are different, and it shouldn't depend on who you pick. As we've said a million times, it doesn't matter who the referee is or who the umpire is. A ball is a ball and a strike is a strike. And that's how it should be. So we want to talk about that branch in more detail, how it would look inside this system of the five branches. But before we do that, we did want to mention two things. One is regarding one thing that kept bothering me about what we said regarding the president having control of the military in this system of the five branches. The president would not have an executive branch to look after the way we have in the American system, because that's a mistake, a terrible mistake. That would all be inside the legislative branch, as we described before. And there would be two other branches that would be relatively independent but subservient to the legislative branch. The server branch and the organizer branch, or the services branch, let's call it that, and the organizational branch, those two would be executing or implementing the laws passed by the Congress, and they'd be subservient to the legislative branch, but be independent of it. But they would not be under the control of the president. The president is not the one deciding, and then that takes away the thing we've had in the American system with the president passing all these ridiculous executive orders, unilaterally forgiving student loans and things like that. No, he has no control. He or she would have no control over what's going on in the application of the law. There's no executive branch to look after, but the president would still have autonomous, you could say, to a certain extent, control of the military. So he wouldn't have to get approval from Congress to put generals in power. He is the executive commander in chief. He or she can decide where to put who to put where, and so forth, and not have to give an account to the Congress. And as I was thinking about that, I began to worry a little bit in my heart, like, okay, but so you have this president who is in autonomous control of the military, and then what prevents that president from using the military as the way that it has happened like so many times in Latin America and in other parts of the world, the president using the military as a weapon to overthrow the legislature and become the sole dictator, kind of a Julius Caesar type of thing, that going from a republic to an empire, and him, deciding to overrule or disregard the Senate and so forth. What would prevent that sort of thing happening within this system if we have it like that? And as I was meditating on that, I felt like the truth deposited this thought into my heart, that what we would need is, see, the police force would be one of the enforcement departments under the legislative branch. So the legislative branch has control of the police force. They can appoint police chiefs and things like that. They can fire people and so forth. It's not the president, it's the legislative branch that has that independent control of the police. Just like the president has control of the military, the legislative branch should have control of the police, and there would be a unified force. It wouldn't be this as ridiculously disjointed system that we have in America, where you have state police, and if you commit a crime in one state and flee to another, you have to get some warrant to ask for an extradition from one state to the other, so if they were different countries. And a police from one state doesn't have jurisdiction over things happening in another state. In this system, police would be police, and anyone would have jurisdiction anywhere to enforce the law. And there's no, like, a police officer is to enforce all the law, not just the laws that he likes, not the stupid system we have right now in America, where the police force does not enforce immigration law. So if they know someone is illegal, they have to call INS from the federal government to come and arrest them. Or and in many states, you have the sanctuary laws where the police, it's illegal for the police to call INS if they know that someone is in the country illegally, because there's this disconnect of it's not a unified police force. There's the FBI, there's state police and local police, and they're all like these separate little islands. It shouldn't be like that. It's this unified force. Everyone has the authority to enforce the law. So any police officer who finds someone, for example, who's an illegal alien breaking the law, then has the authority to capture that person, and get that person through the process of deportation or whatever. So there's this unified police force, not the disjointed versions. It's like an army, police force under the legislative branch, and it's an army because even in America, we've talked about this briefly before. The police force act many times like the military. They have the same similar codes of conduct, and if you observe them, like even on television, which in many cases is a reflection of real life, you see that they do have a lot of this military thing going in them. The thing about respecting rank and all this stuff. And we've said before that sometimes the police in America are sometimes behave too much like the military. But I mean that in a negative sense, because the military itself has certain paradigms that are wrong. The military in the American system, which has been emulated around the world, has certain paradigms that are wrong, like that this thing about you don't question your superiors and you just do obey orders and that's all you do. This very top-down, heavy-handed system, and the police, unfortunately, because they have a military nature to them, also kind of apply that heavy-handed, top-down submission system, and then they enforce it on the citizens. And the citizens become like the low-ranking soldiers in this military system, and the police are the like the sergeant or the lieutenant, and they tell you what to do, and if you don't do it exactly as you as they tell you to do, then they beat you up like you were as if you were a ranked soldier. So they have a military contamination. But that does not take away from the fact that they are supposed to be like a military force. They have to have the nature of the military. It's just a matter of having the right military nature. That's what I'm trying to say. We have our military has corruption in it, metaphysical corruption, in it, and that's what leads to PTSD and all these other things that you see. That we've briefly talked about, because you almost have to kill your soul to be a soldier. You have to stop thinking on your own. You have to just follow orders, and you don't question anything. You don't do things because you are convinced that they're the right thing to do. You do them because you were told to do them. So that if you take away that and just have the military in its right form, then you can have the police force be like the military, but in the right form as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. So the police are like an army, like they are an army. They are a crime-fighting army, and they should have a military nature to them and preserve that military nature, but not with the contaminations. If you see what I'm trying to say, the thing is that. Therefore, you have a police force that is like an army under the control of the legislature. And that means that in this constitutional system that we're talking about, this would be the counterweight to any effort of the president to use his control of the military to do a coup against the legislative branch. In other words, it would be embedded in the Constitution that the police are there to enforce the law and to act as a defender of the legislative branch if it's ever attacked, or the Republican, the Constitution is being attacked by the president through the military. So the police would be the counter-military. So if ever the military rose up to do a coup, a Julius Caesar type coup, against the legislative branch and against the House of Sentries and against the other branches. But especially those two, because those would be the male branches, other male branches. Then the Constitution would say the police has to have to be prepared to fight back, and go. If it's a civil war, it will be a civil war of the police against the military, to prevent the president using the military as a weapon to undermine the legislative branch. If that makes any sense. And that would be a way that'd be the mesh the safety valve or safety mechanism put into the Constitution. And therefore the police would know, having this constitutional mandate, that they're the protectors of democracy in case the president wants to overthrow it through the military. Having that awareness, then they should prepare for that. And have military training, and be given the weapons, supplied the weapons and the training that is needed, if it ever came to them having to fight like an army against the national army, or military being controlled by the president. That makes sense. So they wouldn't that wouldn't be their primary job. They, you know, still continue to be the police. but they already have a military leaning. They would just make sure to preserve that leaning and feed it through training and weaponry that the legislative branch can provide to them, finance them with so that they can rise up and counterattack any coup attempt through the military by the president. So that'd be the measure. So that's how you can prevent the president becoming a dictator, having a police force that's ready to fight the president if it ever comes to that. And speaking of the police and the military, it's worth emphasizing, even though I think we've said it before, that both of them, especially the ones who are out in the field, shall we say, are exempt from the salary cap that would be enforced over all government employees. As we've said, the Constitution would mandate that no government official can earn or can make more than 50% above the national average. So if the national average salary, like or yearly salary, is $60,000, then no government employee can make more than $90,000, and that's with no perks. That's 90,000, no Cadillac health insurance, no condo, no free housing, no tax exemptions, nothing. It's just $90,000, and that's all you get. But the military, those who are in active combat, would be exempt from that, and they would be allowed to earn much, much more than that because they're putting their life in danger, just like the police force. So even if we only pay $90,000 a year to, let's say, a congressman, a member of the House of Commons, an MC, you could have maybe a police officers making $150,000, $200,000, but only those police officers who are out in the field, fighting the drug criminals and arresting dangerous felons out on the street, risking their lives every day. Those people deserve a lot of money and more. And the same with the military, the people who are in active combat on the field, carrying weapons and shooting at the enemy every day and under a threat of sniper fire and IEDs and all that. They deserve all the money we can give them, $200,000, $300,000. I mean, nice salaries. And the thing is, the moment they stop being in harm's way, then their salary goes down. And if they let's say become generals and get taken to higher ranks where they're no longer in active combat, then their salary goes immediately under the salary cap. So a general would make $90,000, but a guy sweating it out in Iraq under 120 degree heat, risking his life with all these IEDs and everything and ambush attacks and so forth, he or she would be making, let's say, $200,000, $300,000 a year as opposed to the general. And that also creates a certain equalizer where the general is making less than the people that he is commanding. And that takes away the incentive of or this sense of superiority that's in the military system, where, oh, I'm a general and you're just a rank soldier. I make the big bucks, I have the medals, I have the honor, I have the big air-conditioned office, and you're just a rank soldier, so you obey my orders. So that creates a bit of a sense, oh yeah, I'm giving orders to you, but you are making 3 times as much as I'm making. But you deserve it, young man or young lady, because you're out there risking your life while I'm here sitting with my butt on a chair with the air conditioning turned way up high as I'm giving you orders. So it creates this counterbalance and prevents this horrible, horrible hierarchical oppression system that's embedded in the military, at least in America. So we wanted to say that. So the police and the military, the police is a form of the military, but it's under legislative control, and both forms of military service, shall we say, are exempt from the salary cap, at least when it comes to people out in the field. And the same thing with a police chief. If you become the police commissioner, you're no longer, walking the streets, then again, your salary becomes $90,000. And I'm saying that just as a number, half, 50% above the national average, and nothing more. So you could have the police commissioner making $90,000 a year, and a foot, a police officer patrolling the streets of some dangerous neighborhood making $300,000 a year. And again, that acts as an equalizer, where the police commissioner doesn't feel like he can just boss and humiliate people around, because he will be giving orders to someone who is making more than three times his salary, and deservedly so in that context. So okay, so that's what one thing we wanted to say. The second thing we wanted to just clarify is with regard to one of the three departments inside the organizer branch, and we called it, when we talked about it before, the Natural Resources and Energy Department. But I did want to clarify one thing, and I think it was a bit of a misnomer when I said natural resources. It's part of it, but I think a more appropriate name would have been national resources. And why? Because and that obviously is a superset of natural resources. In other words, natural resources are part of the nation's resources, but national resources covers more things. For example, let's say that the legislative branch passes a bill, the House of Commons passes a bill to, let's say, buy buses, school buses, to help people out of a flood area. Let's, something to that effect. So, for emergency, national emergency situations, so they need a fleet of buses, of school buses. I know it's a silly example, but just to give you, just to give an example. So the legislative branch would pass the bill, and then that bill would go to the organizer branch. The organizer branch would take that, and the department that would take that, the main department would be the net this one that we call are calling National Resources Department. And I'm always at energy there, because energy is a big part of what they have to think about. But the thing is, so when the bill gets to this department, the National Resources Department is the one who will go out and buy the buses, and then they will make sure to put the buses in some parking lot, some car park, or somewhere to be available in case of an emergency. And they are the ones who allocate the buses in case there's an emergency somewhere in the country. So the buses that were purchased through this bill become national resources. And this is the department that will org that will warehouse these resources and distribute them as needed, and they will do that with all the resources that are purchased through public funds that are storable and need to be distributed in some way. That's what this department would be in charge of. So I hope that makes sense. And that's why they need to be called natural resources. And obviously natural resources like, let's say, coal and silver or whatever, or lithium or who knows what, all those resources that are public resources controlled by the nation, or that are of national relevance, they are to be administered through the National Resources and Energy Department. But remember, it's important to remember that they are not deciding. They don't decide, okay, you can mine for coal here or you cannot. They cannot decide these things. They're just implementers. They're part of the implementation departments of government. Who decides where people can mine for coal and where they can't? That's decided by the legislative branch through the bills they pass. They are just implementers of whatever the Congress has decided, or the House of Commons, as we want to call them. So that's what this department does. So now that we've mentioned those things, now let's get to talk a little bit about the prosecutor's department. The prosecutor's the equivalent of the judicial branch, the judicial system. It needs to have certain differences, especially when compared to the system we have in America. America's dead, so wherever this gets implemented, it will have to be implemented in a different way, and we have to take America as an example of what not to do, kind of learn from the mistakes that America made before it died. So to understand this prosecutor's thing, we have to remember, okay, these five branches are defined based on the five personalities that humanity is given: judge, visionary, conqueror, server, and enforcer. I'm sorry, organizer. Now, this prosecutor's department, which is the judicial system, as we call them now, would be one of the three departments inside the judge branch, the legislative branch. So that means that everything inside the legislative branch has to be a reflection of the human personality of judging, of wisdom and judgment. So that means that the vast majority of the people hired to work inside this legislative branch and its departments will have a tendency towards being of a judge nature, of a judge personality. So you don't hire people with a server personality to work in the legislative branch and its departments, because they will just not they'll not be a proper fit. They just will not work. So it's important that the people in the judicial system have to, and I know this sounds almost like a tautology, like a simplistic statement, but people who operate in, and but it won't be as simplistic as we talk about it. You'll see that it sounds like a dumb thing to say, but it won't sound as dumb as we continue. The thing is that those in the judicial system have to manifest the judge personality above all else. They can't be over the top visionaries. They can't be over the top conquerors. They cannot be over the top servers. They cannot be over the top organizers. You need to hire people who reflect the judge personality as a primary personality, shall we say. But having said that, they have to have a touch of the visionary. If you may recall from a previous audio snippet, when we mentioned the three enforcer departments inside the legislative branch, police, prosecutors, and prison, we said they are, in a kind of a fractal way, a reflection of the three male personalities in and of themselves. It's like the police force represents the judge, the prosecutors represent the visionary. They're the penalty assessors. They have to gauge and discern and feel and intuit who is guilty and who is innocent. So they have to have a bit of the visionary personality. The visionary personality is more intuitive. It's more, you know, feeling, kind of feeling out things and discerning things. And they have to be able to see what's not visible. Like a visionary sees what other people cannot see. And they have to be able to see certain things, like to be able to discern who is guilty, who is not guilty, to kind of ferret out details that are not obvious to other people. So they have to have that visionary touch to them. And then the prison system is kind of has a taste of the conqueror personality, because it's in the prison system, you are conquering the criminal. You're capturing him, and he is your spoils, like a conqueror, you know, conquer spoils. That's he's your spoils, and you're his master, and the criminal in the prison system is your slave. You own him. You control his life. You control everything he does. You control when he sleeps. You control when he eats. You control when he can work out or shower or whatever. You control every aspect of his life. So they have that conqueror personality to them. So yes, these three departments are judge by nature, judge personality by nature, but each of these three enforcement departments, they have the judge, visionary, and conqueror personality also in them, if that makes sense. So it's like the police are the judge, the prosecutors are the judge visionaries, and the prison people in the prison system are the judge conquerors. So that's important to remember. So they're judged, the people that you hire to have, and the Constitution should be clear about these things. They should say that this is the we are laying out how the system should be. And in this part of the system, we need people with a certain personality. Judge personality with a touch of visionary would be the profile for people in the prosecutor or penalty assessor system, the judicial system, let's call it that. And having said that, we need to move away from the adversarial system that we have in America. In America, you know, you always have a criminal and a defendant, and the defendant is hires or is given an attorney, and the attorney goes to fight for him, and he has to turn everything into something that acquits his client. And then you have the prosecutor on the other side who does everything in his power to make every little detail make the defendant look guilty. So you have people, you have someone who's advocating for the innocence of the guy no matter what, and try to cast doubt into every bit of evidence. Because everything is to spin it to get his client off the hook. And then on the other side, you have someone whose goal in life is to put this guy in jail and to make every word he said look bad and every deed he did or every deed he did not do. So you have this adversarial system. So where you have one guy advocating for his imprisonment and the other one advocating for the person's innocence. And then they go at each other, and it's an adversarial system by definition. And when you have an adversarial system, what is the goal? To win. And winning is to conquer your enemy. So then you start by turning the system into an adversarial system, you begin to corrupt it from its inherent nature. It's not supposed to be about conquering the other guy. It's not about Robert Shapiro proving that O.J. Simpson is innocent or winning the case and getting the 12 people, the 12 idiots who acquitted him to acquit him and win the case and beat Marsha Clark and humiliate her and show the world that you are the better attorney, and so forth. And to make more money so that and to win the case so that it, you can be hired by other expensive by other rich clients and make more money. Then you have turned the judicial system into a system that's full of people who are there to conquer, to make more money, to win cases, to manipulate the emotions of jurors, just like an like a conqueror evangelizing, trying to convince people, believe me, believe me, believe me, and tugging at their emotions and everything. So by having an adversarial system, you bring in the wrong personality, you bring in the wrong approach to justice. So that's why it's one of the stupid things that we allowed into the system. Was it the founding fathers who did it? I would say so, because it's been like that from the beginning. Did it come from the UK, from England? I guess in a certain sense, but we took it up a notch. That adversarial system and the use of the conqueror personality, the misuse of the conqueror personality in our system was taken up a notch here in America. I don't see that as much in the UK when I see when I hear or read or watch on television. Things related to trials in the UK, they don't have that conqueror thing going on the way we have it here. But we glorify that adversarial system and we praise it as something good, but it's really it's become a source of destruction. So it has to be removed from any system that has a chance of implementing a true form of government, a government that's according to the truth. So as you move away from the adversarial system, what should you have then? See, the lawyers should not be there like trying to conquer and win a case. They should be there as investigators. And that so the lawyer profession would shift to more of an investigative role. They're investigators to get to the truth of whether a law has been violated. That's their essence. It means that, you know, something, it's a crime was committed, let's say, or a crime is alleged to have been committed, and you're putting someone on trial, you're saying he's guilty. Let's say it's a he. He's guilty of a certain crime. Then the goal is to get to the truth of it, to investigate and get to the truth of whether that person, that he, whether or not that person committed the crime or not. That's all we care about. We don't care about winning. See, who has to win? The truth has to win. So if that guy is guilty, then the truth wins by that guy going to jail. That's what the investigators have to aim for. Now, so when you have the adversarial system, what you have is not people advocating for, trying to have the truth win. They're aiming to have themselves win. And when they do that, it also forces this exaggerated persuasion from both sides, the prosecution and the defense, because their goal is to win. So they start everything they say to the jury in their closing statement or while asking questions during the cross-examination and whatever, opening statements, everything they do is just making the defendant look as guilty as they can make him. And even they, if they have to take something that really doesn't point that much to the person's guilt, you know, they take that and then just exaggerated to make the defendant look guilty. Because and why do they feel the need to do that? Because they know that the other side, the defense, is going to do the same thing. So they have to counterbalance the exaggerations of the defense with exaggerations of their own. And then what happens is many times juries can become either manipulated by the exaggerated persuasion or become cynical to it. Like, oh yeah, he's just exaggerating. So you don't really listen to the truth because you get caught up in the persuasion game and either embracing it, the exaggerated persuasion, or just dismissing it. Oh, he's just, yeah, he's just trying to play with me. So you get away from analyzing the facts, the validity of the facts on their own merit in a cold and in a cold and objective way. So the other thing that we that needs to be kind of the question, I guess, would be, why did we get into this adversarial system to begin with? Why did it become so important for us to have a system and to be proud having a system like that in America? Well, it basically boils down to how the country was founded. The country was founded under the idea that, you know, we want to be free from evil King George III, who was a dictator and trying to tax us to death. We don't want to live in a system where the government oppresses me the way I was being oppressed by King George. So the country was founded on this principle. And then it became like everything was me against the government. So when I am put on trial, it's the government trying to put me in prison. The evil government trying to put me in jail for a crime I did not commit and using its power to imprison people as a way to control them. So, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but in some cases it is exactly like that. What I'm trying to say is that we became focused on a system, on a paradigm, where it's me, it's the citizen, against the government trying to put me in jail. The government against me, and I need someone to fight for me, as much as hard as we can, so that the evil government will not have the power to imprison me that easily. So I want to beat the government, and to give me a fighting chance, I need an adversarial system where I can hire this attorney who will say everything in my favor and cast doubt on every bit of evidence, even if it's incontrovertible evidence, and putting a spin on it until he creates a shadow of doubt in the jurors' minds. Because I need that. I need the maximum protection to prevent the government becoming tyrannical against me and putting me in prison for no reason at all. That's why the adversarial system, you know, became accepted, and having a hired gun that will protect me and do everything to prevent me going to jail. Because if I go to jail, who won? The government won. The government took away my freedoms, and now I'm in jail. But we have to shift away from that, and that should be in the Constitution, very clearly stated that in this judicial system, in this prosecutors or penalty assessor system, it's not me against the government. It's me versus the human rights of other people. In other words, see, the thing is, let's say if person A kills person B, and then person A gets arrested, and is being put on trial, you know, for the alleged murder of person B. It's not person A fighting the government, and the government trying to take away the freedoms of person A. No, it's A. He is in court not to fight the government. He is there to be questioned for having taken away the right to life of person B. So it's in the trial, it's not me against the government. And that's how we always say, you know, even in the jury system, the judicial system in America here, I think that sometimes they say the state rests, like when the prosecution stops arguing its case, it says the state rests. In other words, the government rests. So it's always me against the government trying to put me in jail. But no, it's just me. If person A killed person B, then the trial is not, you could say it's person A against the family of person B. Let's say the B didn't get killed. Let's say that he was robbed or severely beaten. So now person A was arrested. There was enough evidence to believe that he was the one who beat up person B severely. And now he's on trial. Now, who are really battling it out there? It's not person A against the government. It's person A against person B. The family of person B, if they find that they know that A did it, but A is acquitted by a jury, it's not gonna. They don't say, oh, the government lost. The family of person B are gonna feel betrayed. They're gonna feel like, oh my goodness, the jury sided with them, not with us. With us and our family, we suffered this horrible crime in our family, and we were not avenged. We were not vindicated. So it's not really, the trial is not between person A against the government. It's person A against person B and their family, if that makes sense. And we have to get away from that this system of person A needs all the protection they can get, even if they get a sleazy lawyer that will get them free on a technicality and argue and cast doubt on every piece of DNA evidence, creating all this. Person A was not protected from the government. He was protected from the justice that was being demanded by person B and his family. So I hope that's making sense. The Constitution should declare the system is not the defendant against the government. It's the defendant against the victim. The defendant against the victim. If a woman gets raped, and the rapist goes to trial, it's not the rapist against the government. It's the rapist against the woman who was raped. I hope that makes sense. When you it's just a very simple paradigm shift. And when you make the paradigm shift and you put it in writing in the Constitution, it just changes the whole system. It changes your outlook, your understanding of it, because that will be your guiding light. It's the defendant against the victim. Obviously, the defendant didn't do anything to the victim. The defendant should win because he didn't do anything. The defendant is only to lose if he really was the victimizer. But we don't know that. That's what the trial is for. But as long as the trial is going on, it's the defendant against the victim, not the government against the victim. And then when you see it from that perspective, then your whole outlook changes. And if that's your guiding light, you will define parameters that are different from what we have now in America. So the thing is, given that perspective, then it's wrong to have the defense team, the lawyers for the defendant, be hired guns. In this system. You would have lawyers, we can call it that, who would be on the side of the defendant, but we say that in quotes, who are on the side of the defendant in the sense that they will be trying to see the evidence from the defendant's perspective, but not to the point of advocating for the defendant at all costs. So, in other words, yes, there's going to be like a prosecution side, but it's not a matter of winning. See, the thing is, if I'm a conqueror personality, I hate losing. That's what a conqueror does. I mean, it's like people who play. If you play against someone, and they get really angry after you beat them, and they really 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 get into a bad dark mood, you're dealing with a person who has a conqueror personality. They just can't lose. But in this case, see, the thing is, as we said earlier, it's not me against the other side. It's who has to win in this case. Every single time, in every trial, who has to win? The truth. The truth has to win. So I'm going to be maybe a lawyer on the side of the defendant in the sense of look trying to look at the evidence on his from his perspective to see, you know, if I can with the tendency towards lean towards seeing if there's an evidence that exculpates the guy. But if I don't produce that enough evidence, if I investigate and I don't find enough to absolve my you know the defendant, then I didn't lose. No, in fact, I actually by not winning, quote unquote, I actually won because who did I want to win? The truth. It's like a fan rooting for a team to win. You don't want it's the truth versus falsehood. You want the truth to win. If this guy is guilty, I'm not gonna do everything in my power to make him be acquitted because I'll just provide all the evidence that I can find in favor. If the prosecution presents an evidence some evidence against the defendant, my job as a part of the defending team is and even that is kind of a bad term to use. But just for lack of a better expression, those in the on the defending side would look at the evidence and analyze it and go, okay, well, there are holes here. Let's see. And then looking in that hole might lead to looking at other stuff, and then that might produce additional evidence. But if I have I'm presented with solid evidence and I can't poke a hole in it, okay, yeah, this looks solid, then that's it. Then I won. Because the truth won. That evidence was the truth speaking. This guy's guilty. And I couldn't find any flaw in it. It looks fine. I let it down and look at the next piece of evidence. That should be the mindset. But then again, some people might say, well, then you're going to have people who are not going to care about the defendant going to hell and going to prison. Yeah, because remember, it's not the government against that defendant. It's the defendant against the victim. And you have to remember that. And you have to let the victim win if the evidence proves that this guy did it. You have to let the victim win. You can't just protect him at all costs, which is what we've done in the American system, which is so stupid. Okay, so and as I was thinking about these things, writing them down, I had the television on, and low volume. But then I, and there was this show about this trial, and they were interviewing the defense lawyer. And as I was thinking about these things, I suddenly looked up, and she said, literally, and I quoted it before I forgot. I wrote it down. She said, quote, "My client was going to spend his life in prison if I failed him." And she said it with all the sincerity in her heart. It's like, my client was going to spend his life in prison if I failed him. So it's like this commitment. I want my client hired me. So my goal in life is to acquit him. If he is not acquitted, I lost. And in this case, I would dare say, in the case that the specific case that I saw this in on that television show, I have the impression that the guy was guilty. That was my impression, that he was definitely guilty. Well, more than likely guilty, maybe 90% guilty. That's what I could sense from what I saw on that show. But this lady was committed to her client winning, or being acquitted. So again, it's the adversarial system there, and it's also the advocate becoming a hired gun, a mercenary working for the client. And even the word client, you know, someone who pays me to get him off the hook. So you have a vested interest because you're being paid, And if you're being paid for something and you don't come, if you don't deliver, then you'll feel like a failure. That's what literally she was saying. I don't feel like I failed him. Because she also, for some reason, believed that he was innocent. But sometimes in this adversarial system, sometimes the defense people convince themselves into thinking he's innocent. It's like, even if they feel that deep in the back of their minds that the guy is guilty, they will lie to themselves until they could believe it, believe their own lie, and can say with all confidence, passing a lie detector test, that the guy is innocent. And that's the problem. So in the new system that we are talking about, the advocates would not be hired guns. You can't hire someone and pay him a ton of money. Remember, these people are going to be within the government system. So these lawyers are not going to be able to make more than $90,000 a year. Now, I'm saying $90,000 just to summarize it, instead of having to say 50% above the national average. So they don't have no financial incentive. That if you're someone assigns you to this defendant as a lawyer to kind of see the on the defending side, quote unquote, you don't have any sort of legal obligation or moral obligation or moral debt to this client, because he's not paying you. And that means that you can't have a defendant who's rich and wealthy, you know, hiring better attorneys than a person who is poor, because these advocates will be assigned at random by the government as government employees to you. So you've been accused, then the government will randomly pick an attorney to kind of help you, you could say, help you to with the investigation to see if you're innocent. And that seems unfair. No, it's not unfair. Remember, this trial is the defendant versus the victim. Remember that it's not the defendant versus the government. It's the defendant versus the system versus the victim. And the other thing is that let's continue with this here. I was gonna go somewhere else, but I think it's not necessary. The other thing is that it's not you winning, it's the truth winning. That's what matters. So if the truth is on your side, then you should be able to prove your innocence, not by having to pay some hotshot lawyer a ton of money to come to persuade the jury to acquit you. The truth should win out on its own merits. So if we have a decent pool of attorneys, then having one assigned at random will really not affect much in terms of you winning, if they have the right personality. A personality not focused on pomp and drama the way we have in the American system, but someone who is of a judge personality with a visionary touch, a personality touch, who can come in and look at the evidence and try to investigate and help you out. So the advocates would be assigned at random. And having said that, because we want the truth to win, we should have a change. And I'm appalled at how we have it in America that right now, for example, I was watching a show about an actual trial, and the guy was found guilty. And you could look at the when you looked at the evidence that was being shown on the show, And my intuition, my sense of, okay, is he guilty or not? It was like clear as daylight that the guy was guilty, clear as daylight. And they did the trial, and he was found guilty and great, good to go. But as it turns out, later on, it was discovered that the prosecution had not presented a piece of evidence that was slightly that leaned towards innocence. It was not like proving that he was innocent, but it was a piece of evidence that could have been used by the defense during the trial to persuade the jury towards innocence, if that makes any sense. It's not it was like slightly leaning. It was slightly exculpatory, but not completely. It was just like something that leaned towards innocence. Didn't say he was innocent, which just slightly. It was helpful to the defense, let's put it that way. And the prosecution, for one reason or another, I don't know the reason, did not disclose that evidence to the defense team. So when that was discovered, they nullified the verdict. And they had to do the trial all over again. And if I remember correctly, they did the trial all over again. And this time, obviously, they had to, this missing evidence was part of the trial. And the guy was still guilty, was still found guilty. And he went to hell, I'm sorry, to jail, and probably to hell too. But the thing is, we have in our system, in the American system, this thing that the prosecution has to present every potentially exculpatory evidence to the defense. And if they don't, because they forget or they didn't think it was important enough or they didn't see this evidence as relevant at all, but the defense felt it was relevant, if any of that happens, then the whole trial can be tossed out. But what's so sad about, and I'm not so much against that. There's not, it does make a bit of sense to a certain extent, but what bothers me immensely is that that demand for disclosure does not go in both directions. See, for example, because in the on the other side, what happens if I am being accused of something, and I tell my attorney, "I did it, man. Yo, I did it. I could be wrong with this. Someone could disprove me on this, but I don't think that I don't think the attorney is required to go tell the judge and the prosecution, hey, he just confessed to me that he did it, because all their conversations go under attorney-client privilege. So he, as far as I know, if he confesses to me, as a lawyer, as a defense lawyer, I'm not required by law to go tell that to the prosecution or the judge or whatever. And I believe this because many times I've seen, maybe on television, but I think it's a reflection of reality, that sometimes the defense team is talking to the prosecution. They're sitting at a table and discussing a possible deal, and then suddenly something happens, some sort of evidence that the prosecution says, I have we have your client dead to rights on this one because we found this evidence. And then the lawyer, the defense lawyer, looks all stunned and concerned. Okay, oops, my client is going down. So then he whispers to the to his client in the ear and tells him, and then suddenly he turns around and says to the prosecution, "What if my client could tell you where the body is buried? If he let's hypothetically say that my client could tell you where the body was buried, would you reduce the sentence? Can we make a deal on that?" And I go, how can he make a deal? How could he have reacted that way and talked to his client in that short moment of span of time and then come up with this potential deal if he didn't know already, that he, if his client had not told him already that he had buried the body and knew where it was. See what I'm saying? And even so, many times the defense attorney is talking to the client, and even if the client doesn't fully confess, sometimes it's more than obvious when you're talking to the guy, and the guy has his guard down because you're his defense attorney. It's more than obvious that the guy did it. No doubt this guy did it. But since I'm a defense attorney, I'm being paid to defend him, I'm going to fight tooth and nail to acquit him if possible. But I'm not obligated to tell the prosecution, hey, this guy told me where the body is. So in this new system, this five government system that we're talking about, there would be full disclosure both ways. So if I'm investigating, see, the thing is, I'm not here to defend the client. I'm here to see what the truth says in favor of the client, if that makes any sense, because I want the truth to win. I don't want me to win. I want the truth to win. So I'm here to see what the truth has to say in favor of the defendant. So if the defendant tells me, hey, I killed the dude and I know where the body is buried, then I should be obligated under this system to full disclosure to the with the prosecution. So by the same token, if I did not disclose this incriminating piece of evidence during the trial, or maybe the client didn't tell me some, maybe I found some document that really, really makes my client look bad. And let's not use the word my client, the defendant, because he would not be my client anymore. So let's say I find some piece of evidence on my own that makes the likelihood of the defendant being innocent very unlikely. And if I don't disclose that under this system, and let's say that the guy is found innocent, not guilty, then under this new system, we would have to have a new trial. The innocent plea verdict would be thrown out, just like the guilty verdict would be thrown out, because I did not disclose this incriminating piece of evidence to the prosecution. Oh, that's unfair. Well, no. Remember, the truth has to win. That's number one. And number two, it's the defendant against the victim. If he really did do a harm to the victim, the victim should win. The victim should be vindicated. So, see, when you change your paradigm, you have those two things. It's the truth has to win. There's no, it's not a conqueror personality. I have to beat the other guy. I am a judge. I'm judging what is true and what isn't. That's my role. I have a different personality. That's one thing. So the truth has to win. The truth has to conquer, not me. And number two, it's the victim against the defendant in this trial. Then if I have these two pillars in front of me, then I will see the world differently when it comes to defining the judicial system. So there's going to be an open communication of evidence in both directions under this new system. If the defendant tells me that he did it, and he tells me where the body is, I have to go tell. I'm under obligation as an officer of the court, as a servant of the truth, to go tell the prosecution, hey, he did it. He did it for sure. And he told me where the body is. So go dig it up. And we know that he did it. So, and again, there's no plea deal. Okay. Because that's one thing that happens many times. The victim discloses all this stuff to the attorney, to the defense attorney, so that he'll be ready to do a deal and tell, oh, you know, he knows where the body is, but But we won't tell you unless you give us a lighter sentence. There'd be none of that, because the defendant knows if I tell him anything, he's going to tell on me, because he's not here for me. He's here for the truth. And the thing is that once I tell him, it's not to use it as a bargaining chip to get a better deal. So if they were at the bargaining table and then this evidence comes up that really nails me, you know, as a guilty, you know, that really sentences me to you know, for sure, I will be the one confessing, not the attorney, not the defense attorney. I'll be the one saying, "Hey, okay, I know where the body is, but I won't tell you if you don't reduce the sentence." But by then, I have already admitted guilt, I have already admitted guilt. So meaning that I will be sentenced. It's just a matter of how much, and then it will be up to the prosecution to decide if they want to really know where the body is and reduce my sentence. But I am forced to confess. I can't just say it out there hypothetically like an attorney. I'd have to confess, so it'd be a much much better system. So, okay, aside from that, the Constitution should emphasize the relative simplicity of the law. In other words, the Constitution should say, legislative branch, make sure that your laws are as simple and straightforward as possible, and that the legal process for trying someone is as simple as straightforward as possible. And why do we need that? Because we're going to have a team of investigators. They're not lawyers. And that, what we've had, unfortunately, is a system where we become, it's all about technicalities. Oh, did he get the Miranda rights read? Did he acknowledge? Did he speak enough English to understand? And did he nod? Or did you ask him a question immediately after he asked for a lawyer? Maybe you ask him to, you know, for a cup of coffee. Do you want a cup of coffee? And by the way, did you kill him? And you know, and they go, no, he asked for a lawyer like a second earlier. So, and then he confesses, yes, I killed him. And then some lawyer comes and says, oh, he said that after having asked for a lawyer, so that's technically illegal, invalid confession, blah, 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 blah. So they start fighting for technicalities because the law has become so complex and the legal process is so complex that it's, you have to be a lawyer playing legal games to play in the judicial system, if that makes sense. So it's like the Constitution should emphasize the law should be relatively simple and or straightforward, at least. And the legal system, legal process, the judicial process should also be very straightforward. It should not require a PhD in law to understand and operate in this, or to participate in the legal process. It should not be a game of technical legalities. And therefore, what you want is investigators. See, as I think we shared before, if you kill somebody, when you kill that person, it doesn't require a PhD in law, you know, 12 years in Harvard and Yale and Cambridge to know that that a crime was committed, because the guy is right there, you know, all bloodied up and his head bashed against the asphalt and broken bones and blood all over the place. You don't need a degree from Cambridge to know, hey, this a crime has been committed here. So, and all we want to know is, did he do it or did he not do it? It's not a matter of all these technicalities that we get caught up in. It should not, there should be no, so what we want is investigators, not lawyers speaking legalese and dealing with all these technicalities that have nothing to do with the actual question of, did you kill him? So what we're trying to say is the Constitution, by emphasizing the relative simplicity of the law and the judicial process, therefore enables the hiring of people who are more of an investigator profile than a legal games profile. So we have investigators. They might technically be called lawyers, but they're more of investigators than playing law. And under this simpler system, judicial system, the Constitution should also allow for anyone to file a suit very easily, and to have the government be responsible for translating that suit into the necessary legal procedure. What do I mean by that? Right now, if I want to file, let's say, some sort of copyright suit against someone, then I have to hire a lawyer. The lawyer has to prepare the lawsuit, all the documents. He knows all the laws, and you have to present this, and you have to present that, and you have to present the other. And, you know, it's $120 an hour, you know, for each of the little things that he's gathering and all of that. And then finally he files a lawsuit. And it should never be like that. In the new system, it should be where I can go to City Hall and just show up one day and say, hey, I want to file a copyright lawsuit against someone. And then the government's responsibility is to provide me with with everything possible to so that I can file the lawsuit without a lawyer. In other words, they will have the lawyers there ready, like a team of public advisors, legal advisors, who help me prepare whatever I need. So I show up, I sit down and say, hey, I want to file a copyright lawsuit against so-and-so. And then this advisor from the government will say, okay, all right, can you give me a written verbal description, a brief description of what you're referring to, who you're accusing and so forth and why? So I would say it, maybe they would record it, and it'll get written down. That's my suit. And then the advisor will say, okay, to follow through with this, you need the following items. And here they are. He would pull out the list from somewhere based on the law and so forth. And he would say, okay, you need to present your original work and some sort of proof of the date when you wrote that work. And can you help us with where we can find the material that infringed on your copyright? And that's it, you know, like these things. And then there's the lawsuit is filed. So there'd be a team of public advisors. These lawyers would all be public government workers. There'd basically be no private lawyer, at least when it comes to criminal stuff or where you're, when it comes to lawsuits and things like that, it's all public servants. And you say, oh, well, that's the problem. If you have public servants, then you don't have anyone advocating for you. The government's going to make your life miserable and put you in jail and oppress you and blah, blah. Remember, it's not me against the government. It's the defendant against the victim. And if you take away the adversarial system and all these other things, then you have a much fairer system. And Oh yeah, but these, see, the only case where it becomes a concern, and we'll talk about that maybe in another audio snippet, is if the defendant is the government, then things are a little different. But we'll talk about that later. But if you're not accusing the government of copyright violations, you're accusing another citizen of copyright violations, then it's you against that guy. It's not you against the government. So it really does not matter if the person that is helping you out with filing the lawsuit or kind of showing your side of the thing, whether that person is a public employee or not is irrelevant. As long as the person has the right profile, it has to be a judge personality with a touch of visionary. So that's how it should be, a very simple system. It should advocate, the Constitution, as we said, should advocate for a system that is very straightforward, that does not require a team of sharks and lawyers to for you to navigate in that ocean, that judicial ocean. And another thing would be that the plaintiff or people closely related to the plaintiff should have the ability to take a case to trial. And what do we mean by that? What happens many times in the American system is that you let's say a crime was committed, and there's a lot of evidence in favor of or pointing to person A, and it's very strong evidence, and it's almost like everybody knows A did it. A did it. But maybe they're lacking one last piece of evidence that makes it 100% certain that A did it. But then you have a prosecutor in that state or that place that for some reason is worried about his record of wins. Because remember, it's an adversarial system that kind of encourages the conqueror personality to come into that profession. So the process, so conquerors are always worried about winning. But see, the thing is, it's not whether you win or the other team wins. It's always, does the truth win? And judges are much more inclined to think that way right off the bat than a conqueror. I hope that makes sense. So the thing is that because we have the adversarial system and the conqueror personality predominating, many times the prosecution will say, I will not go to trial because I don't want to look like an idiot. I don't want to lose. So I don't want to risk losing, so they don't take the person to trial. There's also the double jeopardy thing, which we will talk about maybe some other time, which is another problem in our system. But the thing is that sometimes, and sometimes the prosecution is biased, and they don't like the victim. They don't like the victim, so they don't press charges, because they don't like the victim, even though they have the evidence, enough evidence to go to trial. So the prosecutor or the attorney general or whatever, never takes the case to trial. And then justice is never served. Justice is never done because you have this roadblock of a prosecutor who is not letting the case go to trial because he's the one who has the authority to send it to trial. And in this new system, it would not be that way. The plaintiff can say, hey, take it to trial. Oh, but I don't want, no, take it to trial. I am, see, I it's not if someone killed my relative, it's I can accuse that other person of having killed my relative. I don't have to wait for the government to accuse them. I can do it myself. And I can file the say, I want this to go to trial. And the people closely related, so either the plaintiff or people closely related to the plaintiff can should have the ability to say this has to go to trial and force a trial. And wouldn't be the sole authority of the prosecution, of the prosecutor, the attorney general or whatever to do that. And that would facilitate free, because many times we have injustices being prolonged because people who are guilty are never accused, and never it's the judicial system is never given the chance to see whether or not, you know, this guy is guilty. And a lot of people get off scot-free for decades because the prosecutors, you know, blockade the trial, prevent it going to trial. And then people forget about the case and it goes cold, and then no one ever picks it up again, because the prosecutors who come afterwards go, wait, if the prosecutor at the time did not want to pursue that case, why should I? Because now years have gone by, the case has gone cold, and some witnesses may have died or may have now become unwilling to testify, who knows what. And I don't want to lose. So this is, again, the same thing. I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose the adversarial system, the conqueror personality, instead of worrying about the truth winning. So one of the things to avoid that is to have the plaintiff or the people close to him having the ability to take a case to trial, any case, murder case, theft, or whatever. Now the thing is, if they rush it and send it to trial before, let's say, enough evidence is ready, it's on them. But it should not be left up to the prosecutor to decide that. So these lawyers are going to come. All these lawyers from both sides are going to come from a pool provided by the government, as we said, and there's going to be a team of public advisors to help people navigate the judicial system from the beginning, from the moment they want to file a suit against someone, and they will just make it easy. You know, it's like when you do your taxes, and you have the software that's asking all these questions. You don't have to be a tax expert; the software does it for you, and it tells you, okay, you need to. Did you do this? Did you buy a house in the last year? And then if you did, then it asks you, you know, for documents. Or I don't know. I've never had to answer yes to that question, so I don't know what comes afterwards. But the same thing would happen with trials. If I want to pursue a trial, then I have it. I'll have a team of public advisors who will tell me and guide me, just like a software tax software system, telling me, you know, what I need and so forth. And they take care of all the technical details. And obviously, I'll have to cooperate with evidence and so forth. But they will it will be much easier because they will be telling me what I need to present and find and so forth. So these lawyers who come from a pool provided by the government, which will include, you know, prosecution, defense people, quote-unquote, and I say defense in quotes, and the team of public advisors in general, they all will have a mixture of legal training plus training in investigative techniques. Now, I don't know if that's like common practice in the legal profession. Like, I don't know if universities, law schools, kind of specialize in investigative techniques. I could be wrong on this, but I don't have the impression that maybe they do. They kind of do some courses on forensics and so forth, I imagine, but it's never, that's never the focus. The focus seems to be, law, you know, studying law and studying the classics from Greek and Roman times and reading cases and all this stuff. But it shouldn't be like that. See, the thing is, it should not be about technicalities. The legal stuff should be taken care of very easily because it all should be straightforward as demanded by the Constitution, as we have described here. So there needs to be some legal training, some learning about legal procedures. That's obviously necessary. But aside from the basic legal training, these lawyers should have a maybe an even more pronounced focus on of training in investigative techniques. How to investigate a crime, how to solve a crime. Like, they should have to learn to be like Poirot or Sherlock Holmes, or Angela Lansbury, or Jessica Fletcher from Murder, She Wrote. They should have that sort of training of how to find out who's guilty, what investigative techniques can be used to get to who committed the crime, and learn on that, become like private investigators, that sort of thing. And that's what the focus of the training should be on lawyers. That's what the law school should provide, and the Constitution should emphasize that. People who engage in this department, the prosecutor's department, need to be people with strong training or skills in investigative techniques. Maybe you might not need to go to university to learn these things, but if you seem to have that intuitive ability to kind of investigate crimes, then you should be allowed into this department, the prosecutor's department, or the penalty assessor's department might be a better name, because it includes both people who prosecute and people who quote defend the person accused. So, and the thing is, in this system of lawyers provided by the government, this pool of lawyers, if there's an advocate who's not doing his or her job, let's say the defendant, doesn't like the way this guy or this gal is helping him, with his case, then the defendant can file a simple motion to request specific investigations, which then can be assigned to other lawyers. And under certain circumstances, the defendant should be allowed to direct his own investigations. So in other words, if the defender, and I hate that term, it should be a better term, but if the defender assigned to me from this pool is not doing a good job, I can say, hey, I'm asking this guy to please help me get phone records of so-and-so, like mobile records, what they do many times, that they track where you've been the night of the day of the crime, and they use your mobile phone information to know where you've been, because your mobile phone is pinging off of towers and so forth. And maybe let's say that I'm accused of maybe not me, I don't like to put myself in that situation, but let's say someone is accused of murdering their wife, and so he's being accused of that, and he didn't do it, but he suspects that it was so-and-so. Somehow he suspects that so-and-so may have done it. So maybe he can say to his to the lawyer, hey, you need to request the records of the mobile records, phone records of so-and-so on that date, because that might show that he was the one who did it, not me. And let's say that the guy drags his feet for some reason. He doesn't request the information, and I don't know, maybe he's friends with the guy, or he knew him from childhood or went to the same high school, who knows what. And for some reason he drags his feet and doesn't do it, then the defendant can file a very simple motion and say, hey, I want, please assign me another investigator to help me find these this information. And then someone from the pool can be assigned to him, maybe temporarily, and that person can go and get the records. Or the guy can also request, can you give me someone else? But that might not be as easy to do. That might require a little more effort, because you have to prove there'd be a little higher threshold of demand to convince the judge or whoever that they should replace your assigned attorney, because otherwise it's going to be this rotating revolving door, and some defendants might use that as a technique of delay a trial because they keep changing lawyers on purpose. So that'd be a little more should be a little more difficult. But the motion to hey, my lawyer's dragging his feet on this for some reason. Can you assign me another lawyer? I want someone to get the records, the phone records of so and so, because he might have been the one who killed my wife. So he should be able to file that motion on his own without the lawyer's help, and then the system should be able to accommodate him on that motion. And sometimes the defendant should be allowed to direct his own investigations, and be his own private investigator to prove himself innocent. And in some cases, to help the defendant, he could also file like a simple another type of simple motion. I mean, these motions would be described in the Constitution, would be laid out. So this would be another simple motion that the Constitution would describe, that the defendant could file a simple motion to the House of Sentries to request specific investigations or disclosures of evidence. And that means that the Constitution would say that everyone has a constitutional access, a right to access to any evidence in any legal case. And not just the defendant, anybody, except in maybe some scenarios that are some very special scenarios that are related to national security issues or things like that. But everything should be public record, and anyone should be able to request evidence about a certain trial, related to a certain trial, and disclosure of evidence. Now, the defendant, as we said, can appeal to the House of Sentries to request certain investigations. Like, for example, he said, "Can you get the phone records of so and so? Because he might have killed my wife." But no one seems to be helping him. Not the next lawyer assigned to him, no one. Then he can appeal to the House of Sentries, send a motion to the House of Sentries. Because the House of Sentries will be monitoring things. They are the sentinels looking out for something going wrong in the system. And the thing is, because their job is to just look around, they will have time for this. This will be filed in some sort of a computer system, boom, sent to a queue. And someone in the House of Sentries, the 100 people in the House of Sentries will be monitoring this inbox of requests, and they'll be able to filter out, okay, this one looks good, this one doesn't look good, and they can act on them. So the House of Sentries can serve as a way to protect defendants in case the defendants are being interfered with, you could say, because of a shoddy investigation that is not helping them with their case. So this is like in a sort of confused way, a very brief overview of what the judicial system would look like under the five branches of government that we have described. And as we said, this penalty assessor's department would be the judicial system, and it would be one of the three enforcement branches of the enforcement departments of the legislative branch. And it would be filled with people with a judge personality, with a touch of visionary. Lawyers who are there to help the truth win, not themselves. It would not be an adversarial system, and are there to and who all everybody involved sees the case as the victim against the defendant, not the defendant against the government. It's the victim against the defendant. If we let the defendant off the hook, it's not that the government lost, it's the victim lost. And we have to see it that way. And in this pool of public lawyers with a team of public advisors, legal advisors, all free, then you have a fairer system. And this will, the fact that you take away the economic element from the legal profession will just transform things in such a mighty way, because right now the legal profession is so corrupt because they have a financial interest in things. It's not, these people will be making the same amount of money whether O.J. Simpson wins or O.J. Simpson loses. They don't care. They will only care that O.J. Simpson goes to jail if he is guilty. Well, right now he's already burning in hell as we speak. So the son of a bitch is dead and burning in hell as we speak. But he got away with so many things. And on top of that, he never, I don't think he really ever paid any significant amount of the money that he had to pay after the civil trial that the Goldmans won. And I find that ironic because Trump was going to have everything taken away from him in New York if he didn't pay this ridiculous hundred and so many million dollars of a bond. O.J. Simpson, who clearly murdered his ex-wife and Ron Goldman. He even lost a trial, a civil trial, where he was forced to pay millions to the Goldman family in damages. And he lived for what, how many years? 29 years. Yeah, like almost 29 years after the trial. 30 years after murdering his wife, ex-wife and Ron Goldman. He went 30 years without having to pay practically a dime of it. And he went laughing all the way. He was laughing all the time. And he laughed all the way to hell. I don't think he's laughing now. Cursed is he, the son of a bitch. And cursed is anyone who dared to defend him. And who still defends him. Cursed are they. And they will, many of them will join him in hell very soon as well. And O.J. Simpson is just like a prime example of how corrupt and how distorted and incapable the American judicial system is. And it all starts with the adversarial system and how lawyers are professionals, are mercenaries, hired guns to get people off the hook. There's no focus on the truth from the get-go. If the Constitution lays these principles out that we're saying, then it will, and we have a system of public defenders, public lawyers, and so forth, it will just guarantee a much fairer a judicial process for everyone, where the truth will win the vast majority, if not every single time. And that's what hopefully we'll be seeing someday in some country somewhere. Clearly, it's not going to be America, but some country somewhere will hopefully implement all of these ideas. And we'll see what happens when the truth is king, how it just transforms a nation. It will be life. It's like a river of life just flowing. And if it happens in one nation, it can just emanate and flow, and just burst through all the other nations that are open to the truth. Thank you very much for listening. And I hope that this was helpful in some way to clarify some concepts on the five branches of government, and in this case the penalty assessor's department in particular. Thank you very much for listening.